Thanks again for downloading or streaming this episode of Maquonics. As you hopefully know, because you've been downloading and listening to these things, most of our recent episodes have been part of the UTS QSI seminar series, but this is a back to a regular episode today. And I'm absolutely delighted to have John Prisco here with me, who is the CEO of Quantum Exchange, a quantum computing startup that's focused on QKD and quantum efforts in encryption and cybersecurity. So, John, thanks very much for giving me an hour of your time.
It's very nice to be here.
As we usually do when we talk to startups or other companies who are interested in quantum, is give us a little bit of a background to Quantum Exchange and to yourself. I mean, how did you get into quantum and how did the company come to be?
Well, Quantum Exchange is the first commercial QKD company in the United States. And we began operations in January of 2018. We built a fiber optic network that spans about 1,000 kilometers from Boston to New York and from New York to Washington, D.C. We also have about 200 kilometers of optical fiber that's deployed in Lower Manhattan and across the Hudson River into New Jersey, primarily serving the financial services market. The company is headquartered in Bethesda, Maryland, which is very close to Washington, D.C. So we're focused on three primary vertical markets. As you might imagine, in Washington, D.C., we're focused on the federal government and the intelligence community. In New York, as I mentioned, we're focused on financial services. And then generally, we're focused on telecommunications companies and how to secure their new 5G networks. I can give you a little bit about my background. I'm a serial entrepreneur. This is my seventh startup company in my career. And fortunately for me, when I was much younger and in graduate school, I studied quantum optics and lasers and have never had an opportunity to apply that until just about 2.5 years ago when I joined Quantum Exchange. So it's always been an area that I find incredibly interesting and, when I was in graduate school, I had no idea I was working with entangled photons because nobody knew what they were when I was in graduate school. But it's gratifying to actually be working with them in a commercial environment today.
Respect to the company and how it was founded, and especially how it sort of developed into actually deploying technology, where did the interest come from? I mean, did you guys have to go out and basically hit the pavement and convince many of these industries and government that this technology was necessary? Or did people sort of more come to you and say, well, we think this is a good business opportunity because we've got a lot of people who really want these kind of things deployed?
Well, we first learned about the technology by doing some laboratory work with Battelle Research Laboratories in Columbus, Ohio. And they were focused on finding ways to extend the distances over which the quantum keys could travel, because today that distance is typically limited to about 100 kilometers before the signal is attenuated and needs to be boosted. But because we're dealing with quantum states, it's very difficult to directly amplify the signal. So we were looking for ways to do that. And there was an approach developed at Battelle Laboratories that we were enamored with and actually eventually purchased the intellectual property associated with it. And that has been one of the cornerstones for us to develop a system that could be commercially viable. And, there are a number of other advancements that we've had to make in order to make this something that could be provided at a competitive price. In terms of learning about the market desire, I think the market is forming, and it's forming in parallel to the development of a powerful enough quantum computer that can break current cryptography. So, you know, when people like Google make announcements about quantum supremacy, and then IBM follows with their announcement about quantum supremacy, most of the companies that are on the fringe of exploring this get more serious and begin to apply budgets to providing a way for them to be quantum safe, because, you know, one can debate how many years it will be before a quantum computer is powerful enough to factor an RSA 2048 or 4096 key. But one thing we know is that it's not if that's going to happen, it's more when it's going to happen. So we are seeing the market form. I think it was starting to form at the beginning of the year. We've taken a little bit of a left turn due to the pandemic, and that has slowed things down several months. But the requirement for being quantum safe is inevitable. And we think that most commercial enterprises and primarily federal governments believe that as well.
So where are you seeing most of the interest from? Is this being driven by governments and the intelligence community, or is this being driven by, well, the banks?
Well, you know, we've seen use cases in all three of the verticals that we're interested in. We are serving one of the largest telecommunications companies today and securing one of their initial 5G deployments. We are working with the federal government, and especially as it pertains to remote workers. As you might imagine, you know, the pandemic has certainly stressed the system with people that can work at home, in fact, working from home, but often working with confidential information. So being able to secure satellite offices is of primary interest. And of course, one of our government entities, the Department of Energy, is very interested in finding ways to secure the power grid, which is typically under attack by cyber nefarious actors. So we certainly see a lot of interest there. The banks are really beginning to make investment in the area. We've seen some of the largest institutions now actually hiring quantum experts, which is a very good indication that they're taking this seriously and that they are looking for ways to create a quantum safe environment for their customers.
So do you still do, you know, do you have a large active research and development team, or is it, as you mentioned, just commercializing the technology that came out of your partner?
Well, we work with a number of suppliers of optical quantum key distribution equipment. However, we have developed an appliance that we think is going to be a critical component. And this appliance solves not only the distance limitation problems of optical quantum keys, but it also solves the networking problems that have been associated with point-to-point optical key delivery. This appliance creates what we call crypto agility. And by that, I mean, we're living in uncertain times, not just because of the pandemic, but because cryptography as we know it is going to be changing. Certainly all around the world, there are organizations trying to come up with new standard algorithms. In the US, it would be NIST, the Standards and Technology Agency of the federal government. And they have been trying to come up with quantum resistant algorithms. They've started with 82 candidate algorithms. There are now 26 that are still viable, and they are saying that it will take another 3 years before they whittle that number down to two or three that will become the new standard arithmetic solutions. Of course, we have a physics solution. But what's very interesting about the appliance that I'm describing to you is that it not only includes quantum random number generated keys in electrical form, not optical form, but it also has all 26 of these candidate algorithms in it. So in a time of uncertainty where companies are saying, well, gee, I don't know what the standard is, so how am I going to make a decision and deploy something? We're trying to make that decision very easy by giving them this crypto agile appliance. And this appliance can provide electrical quantum random number generated keys that can be transmitted over any medium. Could be fiber, it could be wireless, it could be the internet, it could be satellite. And at the same time, have available to them the mathematics solution, which is the post-quantum cryptographic algorithm. So, you know, we think that having more than one solution is imperative. And that's what we call defense in depth. And it's a typical term in cybersecurity, recognizing that there's not one magic bullet that can prevent all attacks. So combining the work that the U.S. government is doing at NIST for a mathematics solution with the work we're doing in the field of quantum keys really unites the two areas of expertise, the mathematics approach and the physics approach.
So, I mean, you mentioned, first of all, there's a few things I want to talk about in regards to this appliance. You initially talked about the length of optic fiber and basically the distance limitations that the QKD suffers because of fiber attenuation. Now, you mentioned you've deployed networks between Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., and across the Hudson. So could you go into a little bit more about this? Because certainly those of us who work in the area know about, you know, how bad attenuation gets and how your key rates start dropping through the floor once you start going reasonably long distance. What kind of key rates are you getting, and how precisely does this technology work?
So we really can create hundreds of keys per second over distances of 100 kilometers or so. But most of the systems that we deploy are hybrid systems, meaning they have optical QKD deployments, which have the 100 kilometer limitation unless they are repeated where the signal is converted back to an electrical signal within a cryptographic barrier that is certified under the FIPS certification that is offered by NIST. But the hybrid aspect of the system is the electrical transmission of the keys. So I'll give you an example. We have a customer that is transmitting keys between its primary data center and its disaster recovery data center. Those are those two locations are across the Hudson River from New York into New Jersey. However, they want some of these keys to be used in Europe. And we are transmitting those using our appliance to London. And that is an application where the electrical quantum keys have the capability of being transmitted out of band from the data. So for example, if you were to have this appliance, let's say you had 20 or so of these appliances going to various locations around the world, the ability for someone to determine what key went with what data stream, both temporally and spatially, is pretty close to zero probability. So the complexity of the network is part of the solution. And with just optical quantum keys, you're really limited to point-to-point communications. So if I want to go from point A to B to C to D, I would have to have a transmitter and a receiver at A and B, and then another transmitter at B to get to node C, where there'd be a receiver and another transmitter to get to node D. So that type of networking is prohibitively expensive. And if you're going to use standard mesh networking techniques, it's a much more efficient approach. So, you know, if you can't afford to link up an optical system across the ocean, this is a very good alternative.
So just to clarify a little bit, because we're talking about optical keys and electrical keys. So I assume the optics, the fiber optics network is standard BB84 optics based.
Yes.
That's actually generating, you know, the actual quantum keys itself from that standard protocol. So what do you mean by the electrical quantum keys? Are you generating the keys optically using BB84 and then transmitting those keys through electrical systems? I'm not quite sure I understand.
Yes. So what we're doing is taking a quantum random number generator, and that will create the key material. And then we're transmitting it out of band from the data. So it becomes very difficult to match up the data that's being sent with the key that would unlock it. And the system works better and better as the network gets larger and larger. So, for example, if you were trying to provide service in over 100 countries, and you had nodes, multiple nodes in each one of those countries, just imagine the complexity of trying to determine what data stream occurred at what time and what key matches up with that data stream. It is really close to a zero probability that anyone could intercept all of that information and put it back together again. So, you know, we can do these optical transmissions, which, by the way, also use QRNGs to develop the key material. Or we can use our appliance, which has the same QRNG in it, developing the highest entropy key material, and using the scheme of out-of-band transmission.
And the actual transmission itself, I mean, does this go through the standard internet if I want to go long distance, or are these appliances running on dedicated microwave links?
No, it can use any medium. So it could use the internet. In our demonstration system to the UK, it uses the internet. It can use satellite, it can use fiber, and any transmission medium that's available to you.
And the QNRGs that are in there, the random number generators, you said they're electrically based. What no, technology are they? They're optics.
They're actually optical based, yes. But they're contained within the appliance or within the QKD transmitter.
And these are weakly attenuated lasers and beam splitters, you know, the standard optically based random number generators?
Yes, they are standard. We don't make them, we buy them. And there are a number of really very good suppliers in the world.
Interesting. So just to clarify before, so your actual boxes themselves and the networks that you generate, they are basically trusted node models.
Correct. We call our product, our appliance is called the FIO TX, or Trusted Exchange. And FIO is just a trademark term composed of the four letters PH for photon and IO for one and zero. So the FIO TX is what I'm describing, and that's our appliance. And that appliance not only has this transmission out of band scheme, but also has the 26 remaining candidate post-quantum cryptographic algorithms that NIST is perfecting.
And these algorithms that are built in, the ones that NIST are working on, are these symmetric key algorithms or are they public key algorithms?
They're symmetric key, but you can download these algorithms from the NIST website. So they are all different approaches, and most of them are symmetric.
So give us a bit of a more bird's eye view, especially in the United States and North America, about sort of the what's happening in the quantum communications and QKD space. I mean, most of us hear the majority of the news with respect to all of this stuff either coming out of some of the European Union efforts through their flagship program, and most notably the Chinese. Given the recent announcements of quite large amounts of funding through the US Quantum Initiative and other announcements made by the Trump administration, what's the landscape look like in the United States in terms of academic networks and commercial providers?
You know, we are the only commercial network. There are a number of test networks that are associated with universities. There's one in the Chicago area. There's a lot of work being done at Columbia University, MIT, actually also quite a bit of work coming out of the University of Maryland in the field of quantum computing and IonQ. But, you know, you bring up a very good subject in terms of, you know, what the strategies are around the world. And we're pretty familiar with what's going on in Europe. Of course, what's going on in China is what one can read about. But the Chinese are doing something very interesting. They have a three-pronged approach. They have their own post-quantum cryptographic algorithm program. They have their own quantum computer program, but they have a very robust QKD program. And, you know, they've launched a satellite, the Michio satellite, and bounced QKD keys off of that satellite and traversed the continent that way. And, you know, we think that their program is probably closest to an ideal program. In the United States, we really don't have a sanctioned QKD effort, and that's something I'm working on with the folks at NIST to try to get them to understand that a defense in depth strategy is going to be successful. And when I like to look back, a few decades into the space race, and what was so successful about landing on the moon was that we had a really great public-private partnership. And, I think the same is now true with SpaceX. And even though it rained on their parade on Thursday, we assume the weather will be better Saturday. And that will be another terrific example of public-private partnership. Well, that has to happen in the quantum space in the United States. And we're trying to lead the way as being part of the private aspect of it. And, we think we're getting somewhere with the government in terms of them exploring these approaches. Now, you know, lots of companies think, well, we have 10 years before there's a quantum computer that's powerful enough to really provide a threat to our cryptographic algorithms. That is really not an argument that is worth entertaining. Sure, you can argue whether it's 5 years, 10 years, or however long. But what's happening now is, nefarious actors are constantly harvesting data. They may not be able to read that data because it's encrypted in such a way that they don't have a computer that can do that, but they can wait. They can store the data, they can store the keys, and eventually they will have a device that can break it and create clear text. So, you know, we're seeing in the United States that companies are beginning to look at this from a risk point of view. They're beginning to plan now. I think we'd be further ahead if not for the pandemic. Certainly we would be. But it's beginning to happen. There's a lot of research going on in terms of quantum repeaters, quantum computers. not much going on in the field of QKD. So we partner with European and Japanese corporations, and we'll see what happens. But if this is a race that the U.S. can't afford to lose to the Chinese, I think we all woke up and realized that we've been in a Cold War with China for probably a couple of decades, and there are going to have to be lots of changes in terms of the way we deal with China.
So, I mean, it's a very interesting thing to in regards to your technology, and especially, say, what the Chinese and the Dutch are doing at the moment with sort of these all-quantum networks. So whether it's the satellites connected to fiber networks or repeater systems that are being built across countries and across continents. Now, your system doesn't have that quite yet. It's still, let's generate key material, transmit it through classical networks that are done so in a much more secure way. But how much do you believe that we really need to start developing the technology to make all aspects of the networks quantum?
Well, I think that doing it the way we're doing it is going to create the market much faster than if we were just trying to deploy optical quantum keys. You know, the limitations associated with BB84 networks and approaches are very hard to overcome. You know, we really need a quantum repeater, and a quantum repeater is probably on the same trajectory of delivery as a quantum computer. You know, it's just fewer qubits required. You know, we have a system that allows us to optically repeat, but it's done in such a way that you do get to plain text within, you know, a couple of inches within a cryptographic boundary in a piece of hardware. And it's expensive to do it that way. But having the appliance, this FIO Trusted Exchange appliance, we think will have the market develop much faster. And I think you'll see companies like Samsung and SK Telecom talking about their quantum approach is to create a QRNG on a chip, and that form factor can fit into a cell phone. That was just recently announced. So electrical quantum keys are going to be deployed at a much faster pace than optical quantum keys. And we're just trying to be completely crypto agile so that we provide all approaches, optical, electrical, and mathematical.
So you mentioned Samsung and their recent announcements of putting a quantum random number generator in their new generation cell phones. So maybe just tell people, what are they using it for? Is the random number generators just being used to replace the classical pseudo random number generators when you're generating random key material, or are they using it for something much more?
Well, I believe it's the former, but I only know what I've read, and you know, it strikes me as it's a replacement with higher entropy key material. But you know, we'd certainly love to hear more about that as they publish more on that subject.
And this is again something that customers look for. I mean, I'm not a huge expert in sort of pseudo random number generators versus quantum random number generators, but my impression was that what we're using now is, you know, if implemented properly, which is always a huge caveat, was already quite good enough at providing, you know, maximum entropy random bit strings.
Well, you know, I think it has been good enough, but so has the RSA standard, and you know, that's about to not be good enough. So being able to start with a purer source of entropy is just a better system.
And I mean, is that in terms of the sort of the security parameters of these key exchange protocols and encryption itself? Is that where you see a big flaw being, or is it more so, you know, in the susceptibility of, say, RSA to quantum, or the in many cases, the inability to prove that a specific algorithm, whether it's symmetric key or asymmetric key, is actually quantum secure?
Well, you know, I think if you look back at the history of, you know, from the days of Whitfield-Diffie and the Diffie-Hellman algorithms, you've seen one constant, and that has been each standard has had a lifetime of, at first, 20 years for the DES digital encryption standard. And then about, so that was from the mid-1970s to the mid-1990s. And then the advanced encryption standard, which we use today, well, that was really satisfactory for about 18 years. And in 2017, NIST called for algorithms and began what will end up being a 5 or 6 year evaluation process. And again, you know, these were originally called quantum safe algorithms. Now they're being called quantum resistant algorithms. And, you know, who's to say that there's not another Shor out there who will come up with an algorithm that will be able to hasten the demise of whatever is the new standard. You know, we have two data points, and they're both pointing in the same direction, which is mathematics can be broken. And, you know, I'm certain that China and others are looking at those 26 algorithms that are still candidate algorithms and trying to break them. And I'm also sure that if they do break them, they're not going to tell anybody about it. So you may end up deploying something that's already been compromised. That's why it's so important to have a defense in depth strategy. And when you're relying on pure physics, you really have a much sounder approach, but the combination of the two will be better than either of them separately.
So, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong with these sort of post-quantum security protocols or post-quantum encryption algorithms. I mean, the ultimate goal, as far as I understand, or sort of the gold standard would be, can we come up with an encryption scheme that, you know, in the same way that RSA is reliant on the supposed hardness of factoring, which is unproven and Shor showed that on quantum computers it's not hard, but what you ideally want is something that is based on a mathematical problem that is provably difficult in the complexity theory sense, such that, you know, only under the instance that something like P equals NP would you ever find or potentially find a classical algorithm that could crack that problem. Are these candidate algorithms that you're building into your systems and that NIST are considering, do any of them have this property that, you know, maybe they're based on traveling salesmen or maybe they're based on max cut for high problem instances, so that, you know, in a complexity theory sense, you know, we know these problems are hard unless certain key assumptions about complexity theory are wrong?
Yes. I mean, I'm not an expert on the mathematical algorithms. I've been reading a little bit about Ralph Merkel's based algorithm that they're looking at. You know, they're all going to be dependent upon the complexity built into them. But, you know, given infinite time, they're not going to stand the test of time forever, as has been demonstrated to cycles before. So, you know, knowing what's going to be best is difficult. It's not like NIST could hire 100 more PhD mathematicians and get it done in a year. You know, it requires a very careful examination. And ideally, you know, it will be something that can be combined with a physics property like QKD so that you've got more than just one barrier to someone breaking the algorithm.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask about was in regards to a lot of times when we talk about changing encryption standards. So, you know, if we're going to replace sort of the RSA infrastructure that exists on the internet or globally through multiple industries, you know, this kind of stuff doesn't happen overnight. And you've mentioned, you know, two or three times over the last half century where encryption standards have basically had to be uprooted and replaced. So how much does this play into sort of the adoption of this technology, the ability to prove that these things are secure, that they're not going to have to be replaced again in 5 or 10 years? How much do people really care about this? Like, you know, if we're going to do it again, we really need to try and do this one properly.
Well, you know, I think that we don't want to be caught unprepared. I think we're currently in danger of that because many companies have not implemented a quantum safe technology. But I do believe when you consider public key cryptography and, you know, how widespread that is today and every internet transaction and email and everything we do is reliant upon it, it's not going to be an overnight fix. So it has to get started now. You know, the new CEO at IBM, Arvind Krishna, has been very vocal in this area. Of course, he's building one of the top candidate quantum computers, but I really agree with what he's saying. And he's saying, if you have data with a long shelf life, you're behind now. For you to implement this in an enterprise-wide deployment, it's going to take years. And getting started now is imperative unless you really don't have data that has a long shelf life or has personal information. I mean, that's why financial customers are so interested in it. You know, I was very interested to see that one of their prime use cases was for high net worth individuals. And, you know, they've told me that this is usually a generational decision where a family picks a financial institution and sticks with it maybe for several generations. So they all want to be first to offer protection against someone stealing the personal information of the client. So again, you know, this isn't something that's going to happen overnight. I don't think QKD by itself is the solution. I think it has to have an electrical component. And I think it also has to have a mathematical component. But again, I've learned that lesson well after running a cybersecurity company for 11 years, that not one algorithm or one solution was ever enough to prevent all types of attacks.
So you spoke a couple of times about this idea of, you know, information that are traversing networks now and people can intercept it, sit on it. And, you know, if a quantum computer takes 10, 20 years to be able to realize Shor's algorithm for large problem instances, then that's okay because we'll decrypt it in 20 years' time and the information will still be valuable. How much of the market is that, of this sort of persistent information that needs to be secure for decades versus, you know, for example, real-time banking information when I log into my net bank facility? You know, if I'm going to compromise my net bank session, the interception, the decryption has to occur basically in real time. What is the relative sizes of these markets?
Well, every enterprise, every government agency has data that fits in the category of has to be secure, you know, becomes a national security issue if it isn't secure. Same is true in the banking market. Same is true in healthcare. Now, of course, if you were to feel as though you had to secure transactions, stock transactions, well, that would be not a good use case because within about 15 milliseconds, the trade becomes public. So it's not useful. But, you know, for example, back in, I guess it was 2015, we had the Office of Personnel Management breach here in the United States. And that's the agency that keeps all the personnel records for all federal employees. At the time, I had a very high clearance, and my entire file was reported to me that it had been stolen, as well as my wife's file, who she was a government worker as well. And, you know, we believe that what happened in this case was that the Chinese stole it. They, of course, their culture is such that that's appropriate for them. And we believe that they've not been able to decrypt it yet. But still, that information is so sensitive. And, you know, it's almost nothing to speak of it in terms of stealing one's identity. That's probably the least of our worries. You know, knowing the interrelationship of confidential assets around the world is a matter of life and death. So every market has that type of data. Now, you know, for me to say it's 60-40 or 80-20, I don't think there's any information that could give us a real quantitative analysis of that. But what's important is that there's enough of it in every vertical market that means this is going to be a very necessary solution, and one that can support commercial endeavors.
So we're coming up now in about 45 minutes. So I'd like to spend basically the last 5 or so minutes just talking about what you think would be the most appropriate way forward, not just for yourself, but also for the whole industry in regards to quantum communications, especially given the investments and the level of technology development that is happening outside the United States at the moment. I mean, if you had the ability to sort of persuade the government and persuade academia in which direction you want to see things going, I mean, where would you put your chips?
Well, I think we're really in the infancy of quantum information science. And, you know, we're trying to do some of the pioneering work along with our brethren in Europe. And what really has to happen is for there to be a true quantum network, it has to be powered by quantum repeaters. So, you know, we kind of need the switch and router fabric that makes up the internet has to become quantum ready. And that's going to take a few years. There's very promising work going on at Cambridge and at MIT in the area of quantum repeaters. And I do think that's on the same trajectory as the quantum computers. So they're developing at the same time. But what we really are going to see is a development of a quantum internet, and that's going to require the quantum repeaters. So, you know, in 10 years or so, we may have a quantum internet, and it'll be much more secure, especially secure in light of the fact that we're going to have quantum computers that are more than just quantum supreme computers. They're going to be powerful enough and with enough error correcting capabilities that they'll be able to break any conventional keys that exist today.
So I suppose it comes back to the age old question. What comes first, the internet or the computer?
Well, you know, it's if you think of a quantum computer as an offensive weapon, we think of QKD and in all its manifestations, either optical, electrical, or what have you, as the defensive weapon. And of course, one has to include in that the post-quantum cryptographic algorithms. So, you know, it seems to me that at least in the US, we're doing a great job in building the offensive weapon, and not such a great job in building the defensive weapon. And we've got to bring those up to where we're investing equally. And, you know, it's no secret that China is probably outspending the United States 10 to 1. You know, we've had the Quantum Initiative Act with about $1.2 billion China has announced $10 billion, and who knows what they're really spending on it. But they're clearly outspending us. But, you know, again, this is a kind of a specialty of American ingenuity. You know, we were behind in the space race, and we won it. And this is a race that's just about more important than the space race ever was. And it's a race we can't afford to lose.
I think that's a great point to end it on. So again, John, thanks very much for sitting down with me for an hour.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
So everyone, thanks again for downloading or streaming this episode. Keep your eyes peeled on our accounts for the continuous upload of the QSI seminar series and actual normal regular episodes of the podcast coming out in the future. So thanks again, everyone. Cheers.